How are you? I'm fine. I'm so happy to get to speak with you. We
Me
actually.
too. I'm just trying to get you off speaker. There we go. Now
Look at
you're human.
that.
Yes, okay.
We actually met some years ago at one of the Stage LA benefits at the Saban Theater. Carol Cook
Wow.
introduced us.
With a gracious sweep of her cape.
Yes, her black velvet cape.
Multicolored,
Yes.
yes.
Oh my God. Bruce, I have so long admired your work going back to the 70s.
Thank you. Very, very, very kind. I found that actually I can plumb the depths of that work. I do these. I go on podcasts and I have these kids who are like in their 20s asking me about these crap that I wrote, the Star Wars Holiday Special and the Paul Lynde Halloween Special. They want to know how did this happen, and they asked me enough times that I realized there's a book in this, so I've written one. It's called "It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time." And it will be out next year.
I can't wait. I knew you were doing a book. So I cannot wait for this. I cannot wait for it. And going back to the days of, right after your Paul Lynde Halloween special, still at which I love and have always cherished, you went and did you were one of the writers on Barry Manilow's very first TV specials.
First Emmy nomination, which we didn't win for writing. We won for the show.
But not for
But
the
we didn't.
writing. We had the best variety shows in the 60s and 70s, Bruce, and you were so responsible for so much of that. And we don't have those shows anymore because we don't have the talent now who could be a Carol Burnett and do a full show and sing and dance and do skits and slapstick.
That's part of it, yeah. And cable killed it, basically. And because you didn't need to make an appointment to watch somebody on the Dean Martin show. So if they wanted it, Madonna didn't need to be a guest on anything. She did her show for HBO, and you could just watch that at 24/7. If she was on MTV, if any of those artists, the latter day artists, as it were, had that option. And so we stopped developing those kinds of vaudevillians who could do it all. And also the form went away. That between that and Saturday Night Live, SNL killed it off because they were on at 11:30. They were so hip that they could do stuff you couldn't get away with in prime time. When you look at the Burnett shows now, you think, well, they were doing what they could do, old school. But the school burned down. That was the problem. And variety TV transformed itself into award shows and tributes and, I mean, crazy shit, Battle of the Network Stars. Now all variety, there's loads of variety, but it's all competition.
And
There are like 17 competition shows.
that's
So
not
we've added
entertainment.
that element, which America loves, winners and losers.
Yeah, well, America, to a large degree, they need to really reassess and get their head out of the sand and look for this full-bodied type of entertainment that luckily you and Michael have brought back with making the Yuletide gay.
Which is like, an affectionate parody of what Paul would have done. Actually, he had a Christmas special. It was called "Twas the Night Before Christmas," and he was kind of a Scrooge who was visited by various people, but it didn't have the at first it didn't get on the internet the way the Halloween special did. And the Halloween special was also a bigger hit because he was already a witch. He was Uncle Arthur on Bewitched, so there was an expectation that he would be funny as a witch on his own show. We loaded the thing up with famous witches.
To have Margaret Hamilton on there, that supersedes
That
all
was
generations.
kind of an authentic, really cross-generational thing because everybody has seen that movie. So this was a Christmas special he would have done had he been able to do it. So, you know, and everybody on it is dead. So what have we got to lose?
That's just it. You wait to do these things until everybody's dead and nobody can complain.
Exactly.
Plus, the estate of Paul Lynde, don't have to worry about that with this particular special.
We dealt with them on it. I don't know exactly why, but because we weren't using anything that he owned. I think that Michael Arrington has a relationship with them because he's been doing Paul in Vegas and other places for years, and so he's just kind of kept up with them. So I think if there was any issue, we got in under that umbrella.
Which is fortunate, because that, I know, has presented a problem in many areas for a lot of creators and creatives because of estates reeling the legal clause.
I mean, they have the rights to certain creations.
Yeah.
But they don't have a right. They can't stop you from doing a story about them or parodying them.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly people don't want to get into a keyboard warfare with them when the thing comes out. Like Bradley Cooper with Maestro was with the Bernstein family all the way. Because he knew that if he wasn't, the minute the thing hit the public, they would be on to him. They would be after him.
Yeah.
And it would distract from the work.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So now,
and we don't want that.
We don't, especially with a good movie like that. Especially when it's a good project. Now, what took so long to bring us Making the Yuletide Gay, and what was the final impetus to say, yeah, we're going to do this?
Well, what took so long was like a wine that had to age. I mean, first the original, the Halloween special was discovered on the internet, and over over 40 years, of course, the internet wasn't around that long, but it was 40 years ago that we did it, but over, let's say, 20 years, it became a thing on the internet. And so Scott Rockett, who's a very, very sharp-eyed guy, said we should do a version of the Christmas special he was never allowed to do. And it came to him as an idea, I think because he saw the internet reaction to the Halloween special, and that's when he called me. I didn't know him before this, and he said, you know, you're the surviving writer of the Paul Lynde Halloween special. Care to do another dance? And I said, yeah, sure, be fine. You know, it was originally, we did it a year ago, and I think it was for RuPaul. I think it was for one of, RuPaul has a bunch of YouTube channels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was originally on that, and it kind of came and went, noticed by that audience. And so I think he spent a year devising a marketing system for it, so that it made a full court press. And when Amazon picked it up, then we knew we had a big circulation potential.
Absolutely.
So that's why there's been this push to get the word out there that it exists on Amazon. So that people will actually get to see it. And I just crossed my fingers that there's nothing in there that's so topical that a year later it would be cringy. But, you know, as I remember, we tried to make it into a genuine 70s show, and all the references are kind of 70s references. Bea Arthur's on there because she was Maud at the time.
Yep. I don't find anything in there that everything truly does fall into the 70s. Right down to those commercials, which just, I cracked up. I have to tell, in all honesty, I talked to Michael yesterday, and as I told him, I'll tell you the same thing. I love this so much. I watched it 3 times in a row, and I almost peed my pants every time I watched it. It is funny, 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 funny. This is bare bones fun. You got no real set. I love the whole, what Scott did with the design, you know, the whole white on white thing. You have a door frame, you have a bar, you have a piano, but it's all white on white, and it's a seamless backdrop for your comedy to shine.
That's right. It's just suggestive, that's all.
and, you know, and one very well used martini glass.
It
sees a lot of action, but this is, it is so witty. The double entendres, you are rapier, Bruce, rapier.
Well, thank you.
With your wit thank and you. What you write. And what I also like is when you write over the decades, and it's very obvious here, you write to the character, you write to the performer. Can they nail that cadence? Can they do? You know, for Michael to be as successful as he's been playing Paul. Right. We saw Steve Carell do a version in the movie Bewitched, and why they didn't come to Michael and hire him for the movie, I'll never know.
Well, because they had Steve Carell.
Well,
I mean, he wasn't as big at the time, but he was, I guess he was on The Office, and so that was something.
Michael would have done a better job.
Oh, well, nobody ever considers that.
The way that you write, it is tailored so well for who's also going to be delivering this, and do they have the chops to get that cadence right, to work on that timing and those pauses.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved seeing that in this special, that it's just so perfect to each one of the cast of characters, what you've written.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you to put together this whole variety show, Making the Yuletide Gay, from a writing standpoint?
That's a very good question. I'm trying to remember. I don't even remember when we actually taped it, but it probably was about 6 weeks from the time that we said, okay, we're going to shoot, we're going to do this. And you know, the thing about variety stuff always was, who can you book?
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that we wanted everybody to be dead, and so we were looking for, with the exception of B, we were looking for personalities who were also closeted at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so we made a little list: Sal Mineo, Tad Hunter. I mean, there was a longer list, but we had to find people, Liberace. We had to find people who could do those characters. And, you know, it's hard to find somebody who can do Tad Hunter and do Sal Mineo because they were not variety performers. Tad had a couple of hit records, I think, but he was, you know, he did music. He did Damn Yankees in Summerstock a lot, but he was not in Tad Hunter residency in Vegas. You know, there was
right.
That was not him. So, that was a stress, but what we got in Spencer Day, who's a wonderful jazz singer and very well regarded in the jazz world, because he was very eager to play this heartthrob. And of course, Sal Mineo never did anything that I can think of that singing or dancing.
No.
But David Hernandez from American Idol can do both. And the idea is, if Sal was a guest on a show like this in the 70s, this is what he would have been forced to do. So it's several buys that you're asking the audience to make, and I'm delighted that they made them. So that's what, once you get that in place, then you can actually create what everyone's going to do and say and all that. And Evie Harris, who is a fully formed character from the brain of Jack Plotnick, and Seth Rudetsky, who was playing piano for him, they collaborated on that stuff. But that's a character that's shown up in a whole lot of independent films. And in L.A. is a stage character that has many different benefits. And was perfect for that era anyway, you know, because the kind of drunken has-been Hollywood star has kind of faded away as an archetype, you know, when you have people checking into rehab every day. And it's all public. You know, the camouflage that they're really, you know, not drunk when they are, is from another era, but it played well for us, for the center of that thing. And then, of course, we had, you know, Lady Bunny, who was basically being Lady Bunny, who was of any decade, but she was like the Paul Lynde character. You know, you open the door, she sings a carol, it's filthy, he slams the door in her face, just like him on Hollywood Squares.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in, does a line, and they move on. That was how it was put together. And it took about 6 weeks, mainly because of the booking situation. Mm-hmm. Once you actually know you've got people who will show up and do it, then you can put it together.
Now, when you get people like this, you have talent. You get somebody like Michael, who is hilarious every time he gets on a stage. Was there room for improvisation during that live taping?
Sure. I don't know that there was any that we kept. I'd have to look at it through my lorgnettes and see. But sure, of course, especially when you're dealing with Jackie Beat and Lady Bunny. But everybody wanted to stick to the script. I mean, they all had input. Everybody got a writing credit after mine.
But, of course.
So they all knew what they were doing. So if there was anything that got ad-libbed while we were shooting, I don't remember. And if it stayed in the script, I remember even less. But I wouldn't put it past any of us.
Now, how involved were you in working with Scott from... Because you are a producer on this, and I'm curious, the decision to go with the three-camera format, which I love.
Once we sat down to do it, we all decided this was the show that we wanted to do. that's what it's all about. Once the concept became clear, and we were all on the same page, to use a hideous cliche, because there are no more pages, we were all on the same screen. Then it kind of unfolded exactly the way we wanted it to. I mean, it's a very high concept show. Yeah. And when you run across people who don't get the basic premise, and they say, what is all this stuff? What is all this? Why is all this double entendre? Well, that's because that's what you could do in what you could get away with in that era. But, it's like the old thing. If they get it, they laugh. If they don't, they just kind of sit and wonder, what does that mean?
What I love about this, and even though people are like, what is that? I think this will open the eyes of some people.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to...
Well, that's interesting.
Yes. I think it might open some people's eyes on this type of entertainment, this type of format. And that mm-hmm. it's
well,
a...
I would love to agree with you, but I think it's a fool's errand. I mean, several people have tried. Dana Carvey tried. Marty Short and Maya Rudolph tried.
Yeah.
Nathan Lane wanted to do it very badly, but he could not get anybody interested, and he wound up doing a couple of sitcoms that bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of thrown his hands up in the air now. He doesn't want it. I mean, those are people who could actually handle this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
but it just is. It's a kind of a desiccated format because you can't please all the people all the time, every week. You just they have access to you all the time now.
Yeah.
Back in the day, if you wanted to see Carol Burnett, Monday night at 10 o'clock, you saw Carol Burnett. And that world has changed. I mean, the appointment television now all has to do with competitions. Who's going to get the rose on The Bachelor? Who's going to win The Voice? Who is the masked singer? It's all built around that kind of stuff. It's not built around who's going to come out and knock you dead with their tap dance routine.
Mm-hmm.
You get it?
Yes.
They reserve that for award shows and specials. I would love if you were right, and I'd love to work on that show, but I don't know who's going to front it.
Funny, Michael and I, we were just laughing hysterically yesterday, and... We both said, what we need now, after this, making the Yuletide gay, we need a Paul Lynde Mother's Day special and Valentine's Day special.
Well, that's exactly what we're trying to do. But we lit on Christmas because it was, it was Scott's idea, because it was something that everybody could respond to.
Yes. A lot more fuel
and
for
I
father.
I thought Mother's Day would be hilarious. I mean, just hilarious.
As I said to Michael yesterday, as we started talking about it, and I said, I can see it now. Michael is Paul Lynde, and have famous mothers, like Paul Lynde trying to make Whistler's mother laugh.
Right. Rockin', honey.
I think specials like this are a very necessary part of entertainment today. I really...
Oh, I can't disagree with you.
Yeah, I really believe that. Especially since, you know, the Academy Awards, they're not even using you as one of the main writers of the award show anymore.
Well, that's true. Yes, that's true. But they had a big upheaval at the Academy. They had another big upheaval at the Academy. And also, they've gone to mostly people who have talk shows who bring over their own writing staff. So there's no money left in the budget. They bring on somebody at scale who will be able to say, no, you can't do that. This is how we do this thing and that thing. And then I get a lot of calls from people who say, you know, they wrote this. These are Jimmy Kimmel's writers who wrote this thing, and I can't do it. It's not me. Fix it. And Jimmy Kimmel's writers are very talented. When they're writing for Jimmy Kimmel, you know, they have a job to do. That's kind of a. They have a show every night. Plus, they've got to plan this thing. So, and there have been a lot of those kind of posts. When they have a host who doesn't have a writing staff at their beck and call, then I get approached.
Some of what the writers write for the talk show host of these award show, it's so pat, and it's very much all. It's the same thing we're going to hear on their talk show if we watch their talk shows. There's nothing that ups the ante. They write for that comfort zone and that comfort zone only.
Well, you mean when they're writing for the host?
Yeah.
Listen, he's not going to stop being Jimmy Kimmel because it's the Academy Awards. He's there because he's Jimmy Kimmel.
Gotta ask you, Bruce, when Alan Carr brought you in to start writing for the Academy Awards back in 89, did that change your life at all as a writer?
Well, the first show, of course, was the legendary Snow White,
yes,
Alan Carr show, so I had to live that down, basically. And although in hindsight, people say that was not a bad show, but it had some unfortunate publicity. So But the following year, Billy Crystal came in, and Gil Cates came in and brought in Billy Crystal, who had hosted 4 Grammy Awards, and so and was, you know, in the movies. So that was the direction the thing changed, and I was writing for him. So once those things were big hits, and that certainly changed my life, because I was suddenly from being the loser who wrote the disastrous Oscar show, I was the winner who wrote the Emmy-winning Oscar shows. So that changed things.
Is there anything that you miss now with your career that you wish would come back, even writing for game shows again? You were hilarious on Hollywood Squares.
Thank you. Well, thanks.
Hilarious.
You know, I just keep going on. As I said, when I won one of the Emmys, I said, my only regret is I didn't have to sleep around to get this.
When you're writing now, is it no holds barred when you're writing? Is everything fair game?
Or do you... No, are you kidding? Are you asleep during woke? Have you not noticed what's happened? It's become a minefield.
Sadly, I have noticed, but I wonder from a writer's perspective, do you just put balls to the wall and say, fuck it, I'm going to write this?
To a degree, but you also, you have to keep a certain level of sensitivity, mm-hmm, because you know you're going to have the opposite reaction. You will have a Pyrrhic victory. You will have gotten the material in, but you will be pilloried for it. So why do that to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you're not at this point. You're not Lenny Bruce. You're not making a breakthrough for in society. You're just going to war with society. But I agree that the comedy has become. I mean, part of what makes comedy comedy is that you're making fun of things that are. And if you can't make fun of things, there's no laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Snarky chuckles don't really make it. You have to be allowed to make fun. You have to have a kind of bubble of protection, and people just don't want that. There is a woke illiberalism that doesn't want to have that happen, and I think that as we grapple all of this, there's backlash, and it'll even out. The way it has now. I mean, you look at their faces because they know they shouldn't be laughing at this stuff, but it's funny.
So in addition to, mm-hmm. in addition to your book, which will come out next year, any idea when next year?
No, I'm meeting with publishers after the first of the year, and we're figuring that out. And because the whole market got upended by the writer's strike and the actor's strike and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to be out in time for the award season this year, but no one knew if there was actually going to be an award season.
Right.
So there's been a fly in the ointment. So we're figuring that out. But I've also, if you're going to be in the UK next year, I wrote a musical with Dolly Parton, which uses her catalog, and we're opening it in Leeds in May, and then we'll tour the UK for 6 months and open in London on the West End next year, a year from now.
Wow!
Here You Come Again. Sounds like a porno, but isn't. How Dolly Saved My Life in 12 Easy Steps, Easy Songs. Sorry.
Oh my God! Just the title sounds hilarious.
It's very funny. It's sweet. It's also sweet. It's a small show with two characters and five musicians, and it's a very funny show and very sweet. And the woman playing Dolly, Trisha Paolucci, is brilliant. So it's and Dolly loves it. So I'm happy.
If Dolly loves it, that's kind of all that matters, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Bruce, you're a busy boy.
Yes, ma'am.
I can't thank you enough for making the Yuletide Gay and for everything that you have done over the years. You have kept me laughing for my entire adult life so far.
Yeah, well, all right. And I hope it goes on for many more years.
I hope so, Bruce. This has been so lovely getting to speak with you, and I hope we get to do it again maybe when your book comes out.
I hope so. We will do it. We'll make it happen. Okay, bye-bye.